Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. On January 10th, 1795, a very tired caravan arrives in Beijing. The travelers have journeyed from Canton on an accelerated schedule through harsh terrain in order to make it to the capital in time for the Qianlong Emperor's 60th anniversary of his reign. The group is led by two Dutchmen, Isaac Titsing and Andreas Everardus van Braam Hoekgeest, who are there to represent the interests of the Dutch Republic at the imperial court. It's a momentous occasion, especially after the disastrous British embassy from George Macartney 2 years earlier. Little did they know that their embassy would be the last by Westerners in the traditional Chinese court. Their journey is the subject of Professor Tonio Andrade's The Last Embassy, The Dutch Mission of 1795 and the Forgotten History of Western Encounters with China, published earlier this year, a rich and readable volume that tells the story of an event long neglected by history and historians. Tonio Andrade is professor of Chinese and Global History at Emory University. His books include The Gunpowder Age, China, Military Innovation, and the Rise of the West in World History, Lost Colony, The Untold Story of China's First Great Victory Over the West, and How Taiwan Became Chinese, Dutch, Spanish, and Han Colonization in the 17th Century. Today, Tony and I will talk about the Dutch embassy, its protagonists, and the nature of the imperial court. We'll discuss the perilous and rush journey the ambassadors made to Beijing, and what their experience tells us about the nature of diplomacy. So, Tonio, thank you so much for joining me today on the Asian Review of Books podcast. Perhaps it's best to start with the book's title. What made this the last embassy? And I guess more broadly, what was the state of China's European relations at this time?
Thank you so much for having me. That's a great question. The last embassy. So Chinese-European relations are quite different from relations within Europe. And that's because China kind of was organized or organized its foreign relations in what many scholars have called the sort of Sinocentric world, in which China was kind of at the center of things. It was the largest state in East Asia by far. And the other, sort of other states around it would send missions to China, embassies to China. So there were no permanent embassies in East Asia. That just wasn't the way it was, you know, in the West. In the Renaissance, you know, you started keeping permanent ambassadors in foreign capitals. And that certainly wasn't the way that diplomacy was done in East Asia. And so Europeans had sent embassies to the Chinese court a number of times. The Portuguese had sent some, the Dutch had sent some earlier, the Papal States had sent legations. And the British had sent one, the one that you referred to, the disastrous Macartney mission. But these were sort of rare events. And so they were typically carried out in the traditional Chinese way. So bowing to the emperor, presenting presents and things like that. It was kind of a different conception of what diplomacy was, whereas in the West, it's not like Westerners weren't interested in all kinds of ceremonies and bowing and things like that. That kind of ceremonial and ritual was very important in the West. But in China, that was sort of the whole point of the embassy, right? Was to organize the world through ritual. In China, the idea of ritual, of rites, was extremely important, going way, way, way back in sort of China's traditional political philosophy. The idea that proper organized interactions between human beings following Li, right? The courtesy, you could say, or ritual, that was the way that society was ordered. So, you know, in Confucianism, the son kind of has ritual propriety vis-a-vis the father, the wife to the husband, the subject to the ruler, etc., right? Well, just in the exact same way, the idea was that states should be organized the same way, with China kind of as the big brother or the father, because it was by far the largest country, and the others kind of, you know. So the idea is that order on earth is organized and supported by li, by courtesy. So that's kind of a bigger answer that gives you the context. So European and Chinese diplomatic traditions were quite different. And in the modern period, that became a significant problem, especially for the British, which is one reason the British embassy went so badly. And so this Dutch embassy of 1795 was the last European embassy to be conducted within the traditional imperial system. And the next embassy that was from Europe, from Western Europe, that was received in the imperial court wasn't received until after the Opium Wars. And by then, things were very, very different. The British tried sending another embassy in 1816, but that one didn't, they couldn't even agree on protocols. And so anyway, that's why we call this the last embassy.
Maybe we could get into a bit about the British embassy, the embassy by George Macartney in 1793. Just briefly, kind of what happens during that visit and why does it go so badly?
So this British mission is very important. Like if you take a Chinese history course or read a book on modern China, like a textbook on modern China, the Macartney mission is sort of considered a seminal event. And basically, so Lord George Macartney went to China in 1792 to try to open up relations between the British Empire and the Qing Dynasty. And the idea was, what he really wanted was to show the Qing how great the British were, basically, right? And the British kind of talked about this. Some of the verbiage they use is the British are the great imperialists of the sea, and the Chinese emperor is a great empire on land, and, you know, we want to bring them together. So he had very grand ideas, and he was sent by the British crown to do this. But he also had very firm ideas about how the interaction should take place. And so people have said that this mission failed because he refused to do the proper bows, the kowtow to the emperor, because he felt that, you know, Britain should not bow down in front of a foreign emperor, that Britain was proud, right? And so people have said that that's why it failed. But in fact, that's not really why it failed. The Qing were quite flexible. They allowed Macartney to go on one knee as he would to his own sovereign. The real reason it failed is because the British had all kinds of demands. They wanted bases on Chinese soil on the coast. They wanted a permanent ambassador at Beijing. They wanted to open up other ports besides the official one to British trade and things like that. And they were quite pushy about it. And the Qing were very aware that the British were kind of an assertive, shall we say, an assertive power. And they were nervous. It was kind of a geopolitical decision. They didn't really trust the British and they wanted them out of there.
So let's move on to talk about the Dutch. So I guess kind of what's the state of Holland and the Dutch East India Company, which I think, according to your book, is falling on some hard times at this point in history. And could also tell us a bit about the, you could call them the two protagonists of the Dutch embassy, Tit Singh and Van Braam. And who were they and what were they like?
Yeah, they are fascinating people. So I'll start with the Dutch and the Dutch East India Company. So the Dutch East India Company was the great kind of maritime power of the 17th century. The Dutch had their golden age in the 17th century. And so basically after the Dutch Republic was created in 1588 or so, the Dutch began to do foreign trade and the Dutch East India Company was set up in 1602 and soon became just this massive presence, connecting Asia, you know, maritime Asia and Europe, Western Europe, for the first time in a really major way. Now, the Portuguese and the Spanish had been there first, but the Dutch created sort of a new level of interconnections. And so the Dutch East India Company had this great heyday. in which it outcompeted the British by far. I mean, the English East India Company was basically just a shadow of what the Dutch East India Company was. But that started to change in the 18th century when the British East India Company began to rise and the Dutch East India Company began to fall on harder times, especially towards the end of the 18th century. The Dutch and the British, they had gone to war before in the 17th century. The Dutch did quite well. But in the 18th century, the British had the better end of the wars. And by the end of the 18th century, the Dutch East India Company was falling on hard times. It wasn't able to compete with the British. And the Dutch Republic was also involved in the Napoleonic Wars as an enemy of France. And basically, the French would invade and to support a sort of domestic rebellion in 1795. And the Dutch Republic would cease to exist in 1795 at exactly the period that these two ambassadors were arriving in Beijing.
So what about the two individuals that kind of lead this embassy, Titsing and von Braun? Maybe kind of, who were they? What was their background? And what was their approach to thinking about China?
Yeah, so these are two just fascinating people, and they're very different from each other. Van Braam was, he was an interesting guy. I kind of think of him kind of like your archetypal used car salesman. I hope you don't have any used car salesmen listening to this podcast, but I don't want to denigrate anyone. But basically, he's sort of a salesman. He's not exactly honest. In fact, the embassy starts because he kind of exaggerates the importance of the event and pretends that he says that other Europeans are going to be there for the 60th anniversary of the Qianlong's reign, and that turns out not to be the case. Something that he actually knew when he told them. So he's kind of bigger than life guy. He's very, very kind of persuasive and probably not entirely honest. But what's interesting about him is he loved China. Now, Europeans had a sort of romance with China, had a, you know, great interest in China in the 1700s. So people like Voltaire wrote very, you know, favorably about China, and many other people too in America. Benjamin Franklin was interested in China. And so in this kind of cinephilia, like, this love of things Chinese had started to die down by the end of the 18th century to be replaced with sort of what you could call a sort of more realistic or more critical look at China. But Van Braam wasn't part of that movement. You can think of him in a way as one of the last sort of Enlightenment Sinophiles. He loved China and he talked about it very, for the most part, very positively. He had lived in China. He went to China as a young man when working for the Dutch East India Company, and he worked in the Guangzhou or Canton sort of factory of the Dutch East India Company. And we say factory, but as your listeners probably know, factory isn't what this was. It was basically a trading lodge that was based in Canton, city of Canton, modern day Guangzhou. And there he became quite rich. He learned about the China trade. He left, went back to the Netherlands and started a number of unsuccessful ventures and eventually ended up back in Guangzhou around 1790, where he began to create a huge collection of Chinese art and artifacts and books and things like that, maps, spending huge amounts of money and hiring artists to paint things that he himself wasn't able to go see. So he kind of had this idea of making a great collection of China. He planned to retire, and it seems like he was planning to, you know, make himself into a great expert on China. But he was very positive about China, and so he's really the one who started the embassy. I mean, actually, you could say not he, but he helped bring it along. The Qianlong Emperor himself had decided he didn't want a massive celebration for his 60th. Reign year. Now, 60th reign year, like, this is an important event simply because 60 years is a complete cycle in the Chinese calendar, right? The Qianlong Emperor originally was going to have big festivities as his subjects had wanted, but he began to become worried that maybe it would be too sort of arrogant for him to do it. So he decided not to do it, but not everyone got the memo in time. And the southern viceroy of the two Guangs, Guangdong and Guangxi provinces, right? This is a very important man. His name was Chang Nin. So basically you can think of him as like a king in Europe. Like he ruled more people than lived in England at the time, for example, by far. But he decided he wanted to send embassies to congratulate the Qianlong emperor as part of this traditional kind of Sinocentric diplomatic structure, right? And so he sent a delegation to talk to Van Braam and to talk to the British who lived two doors down and talk to others. The British decided not to send an embassy, although they kind of said they might. Van Braam was asked to ask the Spanish and the Portuguese if they would send an embassy to congratulate the Qianlong emperor, and he said he would. And then they asked him if he would ask if he could get his bosses to send an embassy, and he said, absolutely, I will. He had been dying to go to China to see the interior of China, which Westerners generally couldn't do. Only if you were a missionary were you able to do that, or a diplomat, and diplomats and their sort of their embassies were very rare. So he was excited to do that, and he wrote this letter saying all the other Europeans have decided to send the embassy, and if we don't do it, this viceroy might not be very happy, and this is a chance for us to connect again with the Qing Empire. We were the first to send a mission to the Qing way back in the 1600s, and now this is a chance for us to do it again. And by the way, it's not the worst thing that McCartney failed so much. Maybe we can make up for it, do it cheaply, and make good relations. So he kind of exaggerated this by saying all the other Europeans were going to be there, even though he should have known that they hadn't decided to do that yet, because he was supposed to ask the Spanish and the Portuguese. But anyway, his letter worked, and the his bosses in the Dutch East India Company said, yes, let's send an emissary. Now, Van Braam had said, I would be happy to serve as the emissary. You don't even have to pay me any extra. But they instead probably wisely chose someone else, and that Isaac Titsing, the other ambassador, the main ambassador. So they chose Isaac Titsing, and Van Braam would be the deputy ambassador. Now, Isaac Titsing was a great choice. He wasn't crazy about China. He was crazy about Japan. So just as Van Braam was fascinated by China, Titsing was fascinated by Japan. And he was a more scholarly type. He had lived in Japan for a number of years, off and on, and had even led an embassy or two embassies to the shogunal court in Edo, or today's Tokyo. But he was fascinated by Japan to the extent that he learned Japanese. He worked very hard to learn Chinese, you know, because you have to know Chinese really, to at least Chinese characters, to be literate in Japanese, although he found it very difficult. But he was a very good person to choose, because he not only had he had this diplomatic experience, but he also really understood how East Asia worked. I mean, much, much better than most other people or Westerners in the world at that time. Certainly better than any of the British did at that time.
So now we're finally getting to their journey to Beijing and the actual journey of the embassy, which sounds, from reading your book, to be, even calling it grueling sounds like an understatement. It was very hard, very accelerated through the poorer parts of China. I guess what made this journey so difficult for the Dutch embassy?
Yeah, that's one of the sort of really interesting things about this embassy. So, I mean, this embassy is important, not just because it was the last embassy, not just because it gives us another perspective on the Chinese court, but also because the documents and the sources are just really fascinating, partly because their journey took them on an unusual route to Beijing. So embassies going to Beijing from the Southern Oceans region, and that would include many parts of Southeast Asia as well, right? And because the Chinese held relationships with all sorts of people around the world, they would typically call in Guangzhou City, Canton City, and then, you know, once their emissary had been accepted and sort of all the documents were checked out and the gifts were checked out and all that, they would proceed upriver along the North River, or the Pearl River, as we say often in Chinese, in English. They would proceed by river, cross over land into Jiangxi province from sort of northern Guangdong province, and then go on a river again. They would go along rivers all the way to the great port of Nanchang, the river port of Nanchang, which then you would have to go on land a little bit there, or you'd have to switch to different boats, let's say. And then typically you would go along another river or go along a lake until you reach the Grand Canal. And then you would go along the Grand Canal through the richest, most famous parts of China, you know, the lower Yangtze region, cities like Hangzhou, Yangzhou, Suzhou, right? These famous cities that were so wealthy and so beautiful and right famous. And then you would go almost all the way by boat to Beijing. So that was a very nice way to go. It was, you know, the Chinese knew how to travel by boat and riverine transport. And this is one of the things, as I was working on this book, I just became so fascinated with the Chinese transport system in the 18th century, very different from European transport system. Europeans used a lot of sort of draft animals and were on land a lot. Not that European rivers weren't important, but the Chinese river system and the canal system was just incredible, the way that it connected all parts of China. So almost all the way from Canton, you know, in the far south, close to 2,000 miles away from Beijing, all the way to Beijing, you could travel pretty much all of that by boat. But it took a long time. It was very comfortable, but it took a long time. Now, the Dutch embassy, the Qianlong emperor was very excited to see the Dutch. His grandfather had hosted the Dutch, and he wanted to do the same thing. His grandfather had also reigned for a full cycle, right? So he was very close to his grandfather, like the Qianlong emperor, the Kangxi emperor. He really saw a lot of affinities with him, and loved him, you know, before he had died long, long ago by this point, of course. And so I think he was very excited to see the Dutch. And he wanted them there in time for the 60th year anniversary, which would also take place in the winter festival, right? But the problem is that the winter festival would be held, basically the Chinese New Year, the actual turn of Chinese New Year would be the 21st of January, 1795 in the Western calendar. But the Dutch really weren't ready to travel until the end of November 1794. And you can see that only gives them less than 2 months, because they needed to be in Beijing well before the actual turn of the New Year, because the New Year celebration begins before, right? So it didn't give them much time. So the emperor made it very clear that he wanted them to be there. And that meant they had to travel fast. And how fast they had to travel is pretty incredible. I have statistics in the book and looking at how fast they went over land. Sometimes toward the end of the journey, they were covering 40 miles per day, which, I mean, in a car, that doesn't seem like much. But when each mile is walked or you're carried by porters, or you're on a mule or in a cart or something like that, it is very, very grueling. And in addition, this was happening. They left in November, and they're walking into winter, basically. After they get off their boats in Nanchang City and they start heading due north, they're walking into the sort of northern Chinese winter. And anyone who's lived through a northern Chinese winter know that they can be very harsh. And so they were traveling during this. So that's why they weren't. They felt at times that they were treated quite badly, but I think that it's quite clear, as they realize in retrospect, that it was just really grueling for everyone. Porters, it took more than 1,000 porters to carry all the things, including heavy presents like mirrors and things like that, beautiful European mirrors and huge, very ornate, fancy clocks, which were, you know, a clock in those days, you can think of it as like a fine, amazing supercomputer or something like that, right? This mechanism that was very delicate that had to be carried by porters. So porters died, horses died. I think the Dutch, for the most part, they had a hard time, but they weren't the ones who suffered the most on that journey.
So I do want to start getting into the history and to maybe some of the bigger picture questions, but I guess one more question about the embassy itself. The Dutch eventually reach Beijing. And how were they received by the imperial court?
They were received with unprecedented warmth and access. Especially if you compare it to what the British received. Now, the British, when George Macartney went there, at first they were received very warmly. They were feted and given banquets and things like that. And, you know, the emperor just became increasingly kind of frustrated as the British refused to kind of be polite as he saw it, and kept making these kind of ridiculous demands, like asking for colonies on their land and things like that. The Dutch didn't do any of that. They were there really for the ceremony. They understood how diplomacy worked in East Asia, and they were fine with that. Both Titzing and von Braun understood it, and their bosses understood it. They said very clearly, this is a ceremonial embassy. The Dutch didn't have any big asks, right? They just were there to improve relations. And it worked. The Qianlong emperor was delighted. And we know this because I have one example. So there are more examples in the book of all the different places that they were allowed to tour and things like that. But for example, the Qianlong emperor, he had a sort of ruling council called the Grand Council, right? And they, you know, they were the sort of primary kind of decision-making body. I mean, it was an imperial system, but he had a lot of help from this Grand Council, right? And they had said at one point, this drama party, you know, because the New Year's is just filled with all kinds of parties and celebrations, right? This particular drama party that you're going to go to this afternoon, Emperor, is we typically do not invite people from beyond the borders, right? Yes, we can invite, you know, the Mongols who are part of the emperor, et cetera, the empire, et cetera, but not, we typically don't invite the Koreans, for example, because the Koreans were the closest kind of, I guess you could say, foreign relations, the foreigners in terms of their relations with the Qing court. They said, we don't invite them, so there's no precedent. We shouldn't be inviting the Dutch, so we recommend not doing that, basically. But the Dutch ended up being invited, and so did the Koreans, because the Qing liked to be fair. And there are just many examples of this, like places where the Dutch were brought into, and this particular party was in the far north of the Forbidden City, where the emperor basically lived with his family, the you know, wives and consorts and daughters and sons and all that. Not so many sons at this point, but anyway, this is a part of the Forbidden City that really is forbidden for most people, and yet there the Dutch were invited to partake in this. And we see many other examples of this kind of. It seems that the emperor is making these exceptions again and again to sort of delighted to have the Dutch there and to show them a good time. And I think show them off to the court as well. Even on the very first day, they're very confused. They get to Beijing. They're exhausted, emaciated. They don't know what's going on. They think that they're going to meet the emperor. They're told they're going to meet the emperor. The emperor's very excited to see them. And they think they imagine some kind of grand, you know, reception, maybe like how you would meet an emperor in Europe or a king in Europe. But in fact, what they're treated to is a sporting event, like a sporting event festival. It's the beginning of the winter festival, and there's a skating event, an ice skating event. And this is just fun for the emperor, right? It's kind of like, you can think of it as a big tailgate where they watch Manchu champions skating on the ice. And so the Dutch are just kind of confused. It seems much more informal. And that's, I think, because the Qianlong emperor clearly loved the winter holidays. That's, you know, it's if anyone knows how Chinese love the winter holidays today, it's the same thing back then. They had huge events. But so the Dutch were invited into all these things, given tours of intimate palaces where palace women lived and stuff. Really, really unprecedented access.
So talking about the ceremonies and especially the Koreans, that's a good segue into my first kind of let's say, big picture history question. You know, the book talks about the multi-ethnic and multicultural nature of the Qing imperial court. The Mongols are there, the Tibetans are there, the Koreans are there, Muslims are there. Was this new for China? And did that reflect how the Qing approached empire building in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's so much great work about this over the last 30 years or so, 20, 30 years, much of which is sort of referred to under the umbrella term of the new Qing history. But we have come to understand the Qing dynasty in sort of much richer, much deeper ways over the past couple of decades. And basically, I mean, the question of whether this kind of multi-ethnic world was new for China, no, it certainly wasn't. The Qing was preceded by the Ming dynasty and the Ming by the Yuan dynasty. The Yuan dynasty, of course, was a Mongol dynasty, right? And that was very multi-ethnic. I mean, just to give the most basic example, Marco Polo worked for the great Khan, right? As an Italian, right? So China and the Tang dynasty is famously sort of open. Even the Song dynasty, which although it was a Chinese dynasty, not what we call a conquest dynasty, that, you know, which means it was ruled by, the emperors were ethnically Chinese in the Song dynasty. Yet still there was quite a bit of inter-ethnic connection. The Ming dynasty, the one that preceded the Qing dynasty, so the Ming dynasty is 1368 to 1644. And basically the Ming dynasty is often sort of seen as kind of a somewhat nationalistic, anti-foreign dynasty. And there's certainly a lot of truth to that, but a lot of new research on the Ming also points out that Mongols and Mongol kind of institutions and stuff were still quite important in the Ming dynasty. But the Qing was a whole new level. The Qing dynasty, so one of the kind of big debates is whether the Qing was an empire. And I mean, I think emphatically the Qing was an empire, and most scholars, most Western scholars would agree with that. But empire has such a sort of, is kind of a dirty word in the People's Republic of China. And in the idea of imperialism as somewhat, how could you say, suspect, means that official history, that sort of official history in the PRC is that the Qing is just sort of a dynasty, right? Because otherwise, if you think of it as an empire, then how do we think about the places that the Qing established control over, like Tibet, Xinjiang, the new provinces in the far west where the Islamic peoples live and where so many issues are happening right now. So it's kind of a touchy subject, but basically it's pretty clear that the Qing saw China as the core of their empire, of the Great Qing, as they called it. They didn't really use the term empire. I mean, it was just all under heaven that they ruled, right? But the Great Qing, China was the core of it in the sense that it was the most populous, the wealthiest, and the place with you know, that had inaugurated the high culture that all the people, or most of the people of East Asia, used. But the Chinese, and the Chinese part was only one part of the Qing Empire. The most important part for the Manchus, or the Qing, was the Manchu part, right? The Qing were themselves ethnically Manchu. They came from Manchuria. They were a Jurchen people who had formed this powerful state in the late 16th century and established control eventually over all of China. But they never lost their Manchu heritage, right? The old view is that they became Sinified, right? They lost their Manchu heritage and just became Chinese, and the Qing just became another Chinese dynasty. Well, no, it's very clear. The Manchu language was used throughout the Qing dynasty, even towards the end, as an official language. And certainly the Qianlong emperor knew Manchu and wrote in Manchu and, records were kept in both Manchu and Chinese, but records were also kept in Tibetan and in Mongol. So these different parts of the empire were considered, they were considered an integral part of the Great Qing, but they weren't considered Chinese, if that makes sense. So this kind of multi-ethnic imperium, I think it's just it's a fascinating perspective. And there's no doubt that the Qing really saw themselves as at the center of a vast world of many peoples, which they were kind of in charge of in terms of organizing things within the realms of China, but also making sure that peace was upheld beyond the borders by through this kind of Sino-centric, or you could call it a Qing-centric diplomatic world.
So in reading the book, I was kind of struck by the wide array of sources that were available. There's writings from the Dutch, there's writings from other Europeans, there's writings from Chinese. You could find the writings of the Korean ambassadors that were there. So there's so much documentation, yet it seems like, in fact, it seems like it is, the Dutch embassy has been neglected by scholars. Why do you think that's been the case?
That's one of the things that sort of fascinated me. If you look at all the books that have been written about the McCartney mission, so as I mentioned, if you take a course in Chinese history, you'll learn about the McCartney mission as this kind of seminal moment in which the clash of cultures between China and the West is began, right? But you won't hear anything about the Dutch mission. Say if you look at a Chinese textbook. So the McCartney mission has been the subject of dozens of books, literally dozens of books in many different languages. The Dutch mission, until my book, really had only three books about it. Two of them were books published in the 19th century, basically by people who were in the mission, right? They were kind of mission accounts of the mission. The other one, published in 2006, was also a mission account, published much after the fact, right? A guy named Frank Lequin became fascinated by Isaac Titzing and so published his journal of the voyage in a great sort of version of it. But so that's basically it. And there was one major article and a few smaller articles about it. So that's interesting. Like, why has it been neglected? But another thing that's very interesting is that it has also been systematically misrepresented. In most of the historical works that you look at about the Dutch mission, the Dutch mission is called a total failure, a humiliating failure. And people talk about basically all sorts of incorrect things about how the Dutch were forced to prostrate themselves under the threat of the whip and things like this. It's completely false. And yet that kind of discourse, that narrative got established in the historiography. Not among everyone. Recent articles by people like Leonard Blusset, for example, kind of pointed a way out of that. But the question is, so you ask why it's been neglected, and I ask also, why has it been so misconstrued by so many historians? And I think the answers are to those two questions are very closely related, and they have to do with the British. The British, of course, dominated the 19th century, right? They dominated they were the great power in the 19th century. And the relations between Great Britain and China sort of most like famously in the two Opium Wars were not very good. And so there's sort of a feeling that you can read the beginnings of all that trouble in the McCartney mission and the failed Amherst mission that followed it in 1816. And the Dutch mission just kind of gets swept under the rug because it doesn't fit this narrative of culture clash. So because the British, one of the ways that they justified going to war against China, or one of the kind of narratives that that accompanied war with China and hostilities in general, was that the Chinese could not accept, they were too arrogant to accept Western diplomacy. And they thought they were better than everyone else and pushed everyone down and couldn't get along with people. And so any diplomacy with the Chinese was doomed to failure. So the Dutch embassy didn't fit that. And in fact, the first sort of British person to really write about the Dutch embassy, a guy named John Barrow, he had accompanied McCartney, and he was very sensitive about criticism of McCartney. When people talked about McCartney having failed, he wanted to pretend that McCartney maybe hadn't failed, or if he had, it was all the fault of the Chinese. And yet here were the Dutch coming 2 years later and seeming to do pretty well. He, whether intentionally or not, just focused on the journey to China, the journey to Beijing from Canton, took all the bad stuff in that, made it seem like the Chinese treated the Dutch horribly, and ignored all the other evidence. And his book was a bestseller, basically, published in multiple editions in multiple languages. And so it kind of set the historiographical tone. And of course, you know, that ramified on and on. So people continue to denigrate the Dutch mission and continue to focus on these British missions instead of the Dutch. So that's one reason. I think we can blame the British to a certain extent and British hostilities with China. But another reason is basically the Dutch embassy, as promising as it was, as well as it went, couldn't really be followed up on. Why? Because the Dutch Republic itself fell in 1795, even as the ambassadors were there in Beijing, right? And so the new regime was basically a French puppet state, right? It was part of the French, the revolutionary French state, and not part of the state, but like sort of under the French revolutionary state. And the Dutch basically didn't really recover until mid-19th century or so. The Dutch East India Company, which represented the Dutch state, right, did diplomacy and conducted war for the Dutch state, for the Dutch Republic, it was bankrupt by 1795 or so, and was basically went out of business at the end of 1799. So there was just no kind of institutional follow-up on the Dutch mission of 1794-1795, because the two institutions that the ambassadors represented were gone.
So one final question, I think, about the Dutch embassy, and maybe to bring forward its relevance to the present day, what do you think the experience of the Dutch embassy tells us about, or how should we think about diplomacy today with the experience of the Dutch embassy in mind?
And that's really an interesting question. And it's something that I increasingly thought about, especially today, because, I mean, just as we're talking now, right, Xi Jinping gave his big speech yesterday on the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of, there's some signs that things are getting rocky between China and the West, especially between China and America. So I'm thinking a lot about this and about how we have good relations. And I do think that the last embassy gives us some clues. So the British were not good at diplomacy in East Asia. They were forceful. They didn't really, they thought that their own diplomatic ways were superior and were natural. They were generally not terribly curious, not at least not to the extent that Titzing and von Braun were. Titzing and von Braun, on the other hand, really understood East Asia. They liked it. They studied it. And therefore, they were much more able to to navigate it. They bought into the precepts and they were really fascinated by it. Not that they were uncritical. They certainly were critical about China, about the Qing. They had plenty of things to say that, you know, they weren't unreasonably cynophilic, right? But they understood. And what they understood is that East Asian diplomacy was not necessarily about getting stuff and about talking, right? It was about talking. It wasn't about, the kind of hard negotiation. So the British, when the Qianlong Emperor went to the Qing court, he had a long list of demands or of requests. He said, okay, it's fine. We can have all these ceremonies and banquets and all that. That's great. But ultimately what we want to do is get what we want. Right. McCartney failed partly because of that and partly because his demands were just too much. Von Braun and Titzing and their bosses they were there not necessarily just to get stuff, right? They hoped that maybe they could talk about some of the conditions in the trading center of Guangzhou, right, to improve things there. But they, their instructions, Titsing's instructions explicitly said that's not the main goal. If you can talk about it, great. If not, don't push it. Because the main goal is to celebrate the emperor's 60th anniversary. And so they basically did that. They understood that that diplomacy can be symbolic. It so the traditional East Asian diplomacy, sort of as an ideal type, right, as an ideal, it wasn't always this way, is diplomacy is about connecting people and, you know, bringing peace through proper courtesies and interrelations, right, in a sort of Confucian way. And I think that kind of ideal of diplomacy is a good one to think about these days. And it certainly wasn't lacking in the West. Like, Westerners also understood that. I mean, you can think of the great world fairs and even the Olympics sort of along those lines, right? That that diplomacy is a much bigger thing than just negotiations between ambassadors wanting to get things, right? But I think today, especially, that to keep in mind that just visiting and celebrating together can be a very, very useful thing. You know, what happens if we celebrate foreign leaders' birthdays, right? These little gifts, I mean, sometimes you hear about the gifts that foreign leaders give each other. I think that those things mean something, right? These little courtesies. So I think that that focusing on that kind of symbolic part of diplomacy, on the building interactions and interrelations, that's very important. And also just the curiosity that von Braun and Titsing had, just to learn about other people. I think that's just a wonderful thing. And that's one of the things that's so fun about reading the sources, that they just are endlessly curious and constantly describing all the things that they see and thinking about them.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Professor Tonio Andrade, author of The Last Embassy, The Dutch Mission of 1795 and the Forgotten History of Western Encounters with China. Tonio, I actually have one last question for you. Where can people find your work, and what's next for you?
Oh, great question. Well, actually, this is the first of my books that actually has an audio version. So you can actually find the audio version on Audible and in various other places too. I think through Amazon, you can find it. So if you like podcasts, you know, I tried to write it in a very kind of vivid way. And the readers that I've talked to so far have found it very kind of engaging. So it might be a good listen as well as a good read. But you can find it pretty much anywhere that you can find books or audiobooks. And as for what's next, I am now working on a sort of longer history of the Dutch East India Company. I became fascinated by the fall of the Dutch East India Company, and my earlier work kind of looks at early Dutch East India Company stuff. And I'm writing a book right now about the Dutch East India Company in global history, specifically in Asia, and how we can how the Dutch East India Company kind of teaches us so much about the history of the world and of modernization and of globalization.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you're listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more info on who's coming up on the show. But before then, thank you so much, Tonio, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.